Show. I'm Bill Barnwell, ESPN. We are here. It is Monday, May 6th, 2019. And today, we are going to talk about some NFL draft stuff, talk about some player tracking data stuff, a very quantitatively inclined conversation today with our, I would say, the analytics guru at ESPN, someone who has helped build a lot of the quantitative metrics that you see from ESPN on a week-to-week basis during the NFL season and during the offseason. It is someone who I highly respect, someone who has done great work outside of ESPN for years and now does that same work for ESPN. It is Mr. Brian Burke. Brian, how are you?
I'm doing well, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
It's an absolute pleasure. Of course, I've been reading you for over a decade now, which seems sort of scary for me to say. It makes me feel very old. But I'm very happy to be working with you at ESPN. And we had a new thing come out this year during the draft, or before the draft, and then during the draft that we used in terms of projecting a player's chance of success. And so given that the draft is just finished now, want to talk to you about that because you helped develop that with us at ESPN. So let's start with this model. I mean, what is going into this model to predict a player's chances of succeeding coming out of college at the NFL level?
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about this model because what it's doing is it's integrating the scouting grades mm-hmm. into something more quantitative. So it's taking something more qualitative and then kind of putting a number on it, making it a little more scientific. And at the same time, it's capturing the uncertainty around how these players are really going to turn out. Mm-hmm. So we can have a model, we can put a number and say, this is our best estimate of how well this player is going to do. But, you know, in all honesty, there's this great uncertainty around that. How likely is he to be Pro Bowl caliber? How likely is he to be consistent starter? Mm-hmm. You know, is he going to make a roster or is he going to be out on the street? And so we assess the probability of each one of those. Most of the inputs, really, the thrust of the inputs is from Scouts, Inc. So mm-hmm. That's Todd McShay's outfit. He and his scouts are grading these players, and we're using those grades along with combine metrics to make the projections.
Mm-hmm. So were you surprised that some elements of either the Scouts Inc. data or certain combine measures or combine metrics were more predictive than maybe you would have expected going into that process?
Yeah, this model is because the scouts themselves have access to the combine metrics. The scouts are aware of the athleticism of the players, the heights, the weights, and so on. So that information really is already kind of captured in their grade. So when we throw in the combine metrics, really what it's kind of doing is capturing maybe certain aspects of a player at a certain position are overweighted by the scouts or slightly underweighted mm-hmm. by the scouts. So it's not the way the model turns out isn't perfectly kind of human interpretable. It's just sort of correcting for the errors that the scouts might themselves have.
Mm-hmm. I was reading Astro Ball a couple weeks ago, and it seems like this was certainly a big part of what the Astros were sort of counting on in terms of differentiating themselves between other Major League Baseball teams who also had, you know, quantitative data to work with. Part of it was, you know, integrating the scouts into a meaningful role in terms of evaluation, a modern sort of player evaluation process. And of course, with Moneyball, it seems like there was that sort of divide presented between, oh, here are the old school crusty scouts and here are the sort of, you know, new school quantitative analysts. But it does seem like, you know, in football, for example, the scouts are giving out grades. That's quantitative data. It seems like, you know, if anything, this seems like a logical next step for player analysis, no?
Yeah, no. Football is fairly unique. Baseball offers a tremendous
right
opportunity for analysts. You know, we've been over this, you know, big giant sample sizes and very orderly kind of sequence of pitcher batter matchups, right? So you can really quantify a player's contribution. In football, you've got 22 players simultaneously. It's pretty much chaos. There's going to be, you know, interactions between every single player on the field. So mm-hmm. you really can't, or maybe with the player tracking stuff we'll talk about later, we're just beginning to be able to assess individual performance independent of the rest of the team and his opponents. So in football, we're really left with, you know, our best hope of estimating player value is through traditional methods with scouts. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that the scout puts a number on him and writes a paragraph about him, and then we stop there. we can go much, much further than that. We can calibrate the scout's, the grading. So let's say, scout puts, this player's an 8, mm-hmm. and this other player's a 9. And we can historically go back and say, hey, actually, when you say a player is an 8 and a player's a 9, actually, if that player really is a 9, then those 8s are more like 4s, right? We can mm-hmm. we can calibrate that scale and make it much more useful quantitatively. We can also look at certain traits. So scouts are not just putting a single grade on a player, but they're saying his, let's say we're talking about a running back, so his running production could be, one score. His pass blocking, blitz pickup could right. be another score. His receiving skills could be another score. Scouts are very fond of making intangibles, a grade for intangibles. So we can go back and say, hey, these traits really matter and these traits don't matter, or you need to make an adjustment to how you're grading these. So there's so much more we can do with those grades rather than just kind of stop at that point. We can really, there's a feedback mechanism we can give those scouts to really improve what they do.
Mm-hmm. And it makes sense, right? You figure, when we think about players, we think, okay, well, they have strengths and weaknesses. You have a guy who might be good, like with running backs, a great pass blocker, great pass receiver, might not be a great runner between the tackles. Same thing naturally should be true of scouts, right? You might have a scout who's great at evaluating running backs, but maybe he was a defensive back coming out of school when he played, earlier in his career. And because of that, he might be blind towards traits that weren't part of his skill set. It might be biased towards players who played like him, perhaps. I mean, there's such value in self-scouting, and, at least from what I know, and I'm sure you know this as well, in talking to teams, I think a lot of smart teams really do a bunch of self-scouting and go back and judge their scouts' reports from the past just to figure out, hey, how does this scout do? Are they good at evaluating this element? Are they good at evaluating this position? Is it something they have a blind spot towards? There's such tremendous value in that, because then you can figure out what is actually meaningful from what the scouts are putting out versus what might not be quite as clear.
Yeah, no, exactly. So, the goal is really to improve the scouts themselves. We can grade scouts just like we can grade players, right? You can, mm-hmm. you have like scouts, right? It's like Inception scouting.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's really fascinating to me. In terms of how fans evaluate the draft, certainly, Monday morning, there is that sort of, we're going to put our grades out, from the media, and fans do this too. Like, I think we all recognize there's some level of naivete to it, and you have to adjust it for future years, but the grades come out, and I think there is that sort of that fan idea, and to some extent, I think a media idea as well, of just boom bust. A guy is either an absolute hit and he's a star, or he is a bust and he's a disappointment and doesn't deserve to ever play football again. And what I like about this, and I think what, really adds a lot of value, is that there is a real range of different outcomes, and that's different for different positions, but, in modeling this stuff, it seems like there was a really important emphasis placed on differentiation between, different levels of success for these draft picks.
I've gone back and forth on this. I'm not sure I'm answering your question exactly.
That's fine.
I think, so, I used to think, well, you have to wait 5 years, see how these players really turn out mm-hmm. to go back to be able to assess and judge how well a team did in terms of making their selections. And that seems to be right. And it seems like maybe the wise thing to do is not to, put a letter grade on a team or a player mm-hmm. right away. But I've come around to think that really that's not the best way to do it. I think you have to make judgments about decisions mm-hmm. given the information you have at the time, right? So on draft day, you don't get to see how these players turn out. Yeah, it's fine to say, this one GM is really good at picking defensive backs or something like that because they've all turned out down the road. But I think it is very fair for critics and fans to make a judgment on how well these teams did in terms of their draft day, not just who they select, mm-hmm. but where they move. Right, so you could move down and take the same player come away with more picks, and so there's a lot of different decisions you can you can assess. And I think in some cases, the average fan may be more savvy about some of these things than some GMs. I think the fan base has become very well educated, and I think some of these criticisms are fair.
Interesting. Now, in the past, you built a sort of Bayesian predictor of how likely it is that each player is going to be available at a given point in the draft, and you built that using mock draft data, no?
The way it would work, it took guys like Kuiper and McShay and a number of other analysts from, you know, across the media, Mayock, for example, and it would take their mock drafts, and it would say, okay, given that these mock drafts have this player taken at this spot or at this spot or at this spot, how likely are they to be picked at every one of the, you know, 200 and whatever number of picks there are in the entire draft? And so now you get you can throw in some more information too, like positional information, like what are each team's positional needs? Mm-hmm. Are they already set at quarterback? Do they have a franchise quarterback in place? Okay, that changes how they're gonna draft. There's some uncertainty in there because trades can always happen too. And given all those things, how likely is a player to come off the board at pick number one, at pick number two, at pick number three, and so on? And the whole idea there was teams could use that in order to make a judgment of how high up in the draft do they need to move to be safely assured of getting a certain player, or how far back can, say, I don't know, the Giants fall back and still get the player that they were targeting.
Right.
With some reasonable confidence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really love that tool. I thought it was really interesting. All right, Brian, let's talk about this NFL projection model more in a minute. But first, wanted to talk about our pals at SeatGeek. And if you are excited about going to see any of the NFL rookies play this year, your chance to buy tickets to any of their games is with our friends at SeatGeek. And of course, SeatGeek is not just getting you tickets for football games, not just getting you tickets for sporting events. You can get tickets to concerts. You can get tickets to plays. I bought a ticket to a concert last week on SeatGeek. I'm going to the UK. I bought tickets to a UK concert. I think I'm going to see Built to Spill in the UK, and I'm going to see them with our friends at SeatGeek helping me along the way. SeatGeek, even better, is using their technology to pull in millions of tickets from all over the web. They are rating each deal on a scale of 1 to 10 and then displaying them on an interactive seat map. So it's simple to find what you're looking for. Green dots are good deals. Red dots are not good deals. Don't buy those red dot tickets. Buy the green dot tickets. The tickets are fully guaranteed, so you can shop with confidence. And you can get $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase because SeatGeek supports our show. And I would highly recommend you support them as well. And to do that, use our promo code, which is Barnwell, my last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L. Use promo code Barnwell and get $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. You can use that for concert tickets, sports, comedy, whatever you want. That's promo code Barnwell for $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase today. Now back to the show. In terms of the sort of the draft model as a whole, is there a source of information or a concept or some sort of data you'd like to add to it in the years to come to hopefully make it more predictive?
Oh, in terms of that model, gosh, I think, yeah, the broader, the more kind of wisdom of crowds you can get. So the more, say, mock trades. My original idea for that draft predictor was to try to get, like, thousands and thousands and thousands of fan-generated mock drafts, and then use kind of the wisdom of crowds concept to kind of average that out and do that. So that became infeasible, so I said, well, let's just use these, you know, expert mock drafts. And so, you know, Mel's going to be wrong here, and Todd's going to be wrong there, but if I have enough of those guys, they'll average out to, you know, one person's errors will cancel out another person's errors. If you have enough of these guys, so I would just say the bigger the number of experts I can include, the better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what about the draft projection model? Is there information you'd like to add to that in the years to come?
Well, yeah. Right now, it's relying on that single number grade, that player grade for from Scouts Inc., and that's really what's what's driving that model. So, you know, Dwayne Haskins might be a 90, Kyler Murray might be a 91, something like that. So there's just a number from 1 to 99 that these players are graded on. Mm-hmm. They've, like I was mentioning before, they also have grades for a number of different traits, and those right. traits are position specific. The problem, I would love to use that trait information in the projections. The only problem is we don't go far back, and we don't have enough years worth of data in order to use all those traits. We do have enough years of just the single grade, the overall grade. So we have enough data there to run the model. So it'll take a couple more years, I think, before we have enough data to do that. These things tend to be pretty data hungry.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, and really, it's fascinating in that, you know, even going back to my own research, going back and looking at injury data, for example, you know, I think there's stuff that exists, and I know for me, like, I would stumble onto things that I didn't know existed, like an old, you know, ESPN page that happened to have injury reports for a few weeks, or specific injury data that I didn't have anywhere else, or an old, like, CNN SI page, and you just sort of have to get lucky sometimes. Or, you know, you can be really good at searching, and that helps, but, like, you just have to get lucky and kind of stumble on a data source that actually has meaningful, you know, information at the time. And something like, you know, when I'm going back and trying to figure out how a player was perceived at the time, I go back through RotoWorld a few years just to see what the reports were at the time, because that's, you know, getting that information in context that's not being judged years after the fact is so valuable. But that's, you know, even though it might exist somewhere on the internet, you have to kind of get lucky to find it.
Oh, I've got you beat there. So
I'm sure.
My dad was one of the original draft Knicks. So
really?
he was one of these people in like the late 70s, early 80s, who's just so excited for the draft. And ESPN put it on TV, like it was on like Thursday afternoon. He would like take off from work to watch the draft. And he would subscribe to all the different newsletters. And I was a little kid. I was like, Dad, let's buy a computer. I want a computer. Let's buy a computer. And he's like, no. We only really bought a computer so he could build his own little draft tracker on this software, this forerunner of Excel called Lotus 1-2-3. And so that's my experience. And so when it came time to like build this build that Bayesian draft predictor we were just talking about, I was like, I need as many years of data as I can get. And so my dad's basement had boxes full of old like Mel Kiper newsletters and Pro Football Weeklies that, you know, went back to like the late 70s when like Kiper was like 19 years old. So there's an amazing amount of data out there if you're willing to go after it.
For sure. Is there, like you said, you know, you're still obviously a model in progress, but is there any prominent player, you know, a guy thinking in the top 10 where because his scouts grade was not especially impressive, because the combine data was not especially enthralling, a player whose chances of success aren't as impressive as maybe their new team's fans might think right now?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I mean, well, the one that jumps out is Daniel Jones, but I would say that team's fans are appropriately concerned, though. and that's really just a function of where the Scouts Inc. guys put his grade. I think his grade was a 79, and so the top quarterbacks, like I mentioned before, were up normally 90s. Somebody, you know, a Peyton Manning or an Andrew Luck, somebody like that they've been 99s in the past. So you're getting somebody the scout said was more likely a 79, and that puts him historically somebody with that Scouts Inc. grade becomes a Pro Bowl caliber player. Just has a 4 or 5% chance compared to something like a 20% chance for somebody who's graded up in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, looking at the projections here, it's at ESPN.com/NFL/draft/projections. I mean, his, you know, a similar sort of profile to someone like a Ryan Finley or even a Tyree Jackson. Tyree Jackson, of course, was undrafted. Maybe even a worse profile than those guys, unfortunately for Giants fans. But we will see. Certainly a lot of time to come for Daniel Jones and a lot of time to come for this draft model. We're going to talk about some really cool next-gen data stuff that's coming out from Brian in the, some out now and some in the years to come after the break here on the Bill Barnwell Show. All right, back here on the Bill Barnwell Show, I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN, joined again by Brian Burke of ESPN. And let's talk about some of the stuff we've built using the player tracking data that is generated by the NFL's Next Gen Stats. And Brian, just for the uninitiated, what is the NFL doing in terms of player tracking data on a play-by-play basis?
NFL's got this product called Next Gen Stats. You've probably seen it on our air, some other networks as well, that tracks every player on every play. There are two chips, one on each shoulder pad, and you get position, velocities, accelerations, player orientation throughout the play at like a, you know, once every tenth of a second update too. Wow. So it's pretty amazing. It's in near real time, so you get the information as right after the play has happened. So you can do tremendous analysis with that. We're just really just getting started, scratching the surface on that stuff.
Yeah. So one of the things you built for SDSPN that was public this year was our pass block and pass rush win rate data for offensive and defensive linemen. So what is that gauging, and sort of what is the framework for judging a success when it comes to a pass block or a pass rush attempt?
Yeah, so this is something I've been wanting to do for a long time. Everyone's familiar, or most people should be familiar, with traditional time in pocket stats,
yep.
Right? Like, let's say Ben Roethlisberger's average time in pocket is 2.6 seconds, right? And another player's is, 2.8 seconds. And so you make some judgment about how the pass protection for Ben Roethlisberger compares to some other teams.
Mm-hmm.
The problem there is that as soon as he releases the ball in a pass, the clock stops, right? So the same thing happens. You stop the clock in the same way as if he had been sacked at that moment. But you don't know when he may have been sacked in the future, right, after those 2.6 seconds have expired. So it's a what we call it's a survival model. The time in pocket stats are, by their nature, unreliable. They don't really tell you anything. A quarterback could be releasing the ball quickly, or he could have a sieve for an offensive line.
Mm-hmm.
And either one is going to give you the same information. So what I wanted to do was have a much better way of assessing how well offensive lines are blocking and how well pass rushers are getting to the quarterback. So mm-hmm. That was the genesis of this. And the player tracking data is what allows that to happen. And it's really pretty simple. If you are, if you're close to me, really close to me, and you're facing me, then you're probably blocking me. And if I am closer to the quarterback than you are, and you're trying to block me, that means I've won the block, right? Either that or you're holding me. Either one, I win. And so not only can we tell who's blocking who, and if it's a double team or not, or, we can also tell how long that block was sustained.
Mm-hmm.
So take Joe Thomas is a great example. Joe Thomas, a left tackle for the Browns for a long time. He'll mostly be a Hall of Famer. He was something like 55th in tackles in terms of his pressures allowed,
right,
in traditional metrics, which is bottom of the pack, right? There's only like 64 starting tackles in the league.
Right.
But he was, I think, second in pass block win rate, because what was happening is he was sustaining his blocks for a long time, but say, you know, whoever Cleveland had under center at the time couldn't make reads, they're holding on to the ball too long, and so it was the quarterback that was generating the sacks. It wasn't Joe Thomas that was allowing those. So time is a really important element. So we put, just to simplify things for fans, we threw a marker down at 2.5 seconds. So that's about the average time to release for a pass in the NFL. And so if you can sustain the block for 2.5 seconds or longer, we call that a pass block win. If the pass rusher wins the block by 2.5, we call that a pass rush win.
Mm-hmm. I mean, 2.5, like you said, it makes sense. That's usually, I think maybe it's like, yeah, I think it's between 2.5 and 2.6 seconds in a typical season for a pass to be released. Were you surprised by what you found? Like, did it match up with sort of the popular perceptions of, oh, well, these are the good offensive linemen, these are the good defensive linemen, or were there guys who slipped in where it made you think, wow, you know, these guys are maybe more impressive than we give them credit for publicly? And this is also, just to be clear, this was built off 2 years of next-gen data and then was released publicly for the first time this year?
Yeah, so this past season, 2018, was the first time we publicly released the rankings. The it's based. I can't say it's really. It's not based on any years of data because there's no regression model. This is really just kind of physics. You know, it's geometry. Am I closer to him or are you closer to him? And so there's no kind of Y variable. There's no kind of traditional analytical mathematical model at work. Mm-hmm. So it's really pretty simple at heart. The one thing that really jumped out at me was we started creating. Yes, most of the great players you think are great do come up as very good in pass block win rate. On the flip side, on the defensive side, what we found was the surprising thing was some of the sack leaders were really kind of feasting off of other players, say interior linemen, who were generating pressure, flushing quarterback into a defensive end's arms. So if you can generate interior pressure, you change the geometry. Once that quarterback kind of is flushed from the pocket, the defensive end is no longer essentially being blocked. And so a lot of sacks are getting credited kind of to the wrong person. So we created a secondary metric we called sacks created. So if there's a sack on the play, we give credit to whoever the first player was who won their block and created pressure on the quarterback. So
makes sense.
There's some, you know, like for a long time, a lot of, say, J.J. Watt sacks were thanks to Jadeveon Clowney's pressure. And they would move around. They would move these guys around on the line of scrimmage, but it was Clowney who's kind of generating the pressure and then Watt kind of finishing off the play. Later in the season, things tended to even out, but that's one example of that.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. Do you think, maybe it's too early to say, and that's fine, do you think in general, one side of that sort of equation is going to be more predictive or more consistent than the other, like in terms of pass blocking or pass rushing?
Oh, yeah. Interesting that you asked that. We've been looking at that. So we can test, like, how much of this is really skill-based and how much of it is kind of luck-based.
Right.
How much of it is kind of consistent week to week. So something that is a definite skill will be consistent from week to week to week to week. And what we found is the offensive side, the pass blocking, is much more consistent from week to week than pass rushing. So if pass rushing success has a lot to do with who you're playing against, and pass blocking success has more to do with, like, how good you are yourself.
Interesting.
So, yeah, that was very surprising, and it varies from year to year. So we'd like to have a few more years of data before we're, you know, make any kind of conclusions about it. But I would, you know, if I were a GM, I would be investing a lot of my cap space into and draft capital into a really good offensive line. That seems to be, I mean, it's obvious, right? But I think it's even more so than people are already aware.
Right, of course. What sort of improvements do you think you guys can make? I mean, do you think it's something where you're fully, you know, do you feel comfortable fully accounting for the elements of scheme and for coach and for concepts? Like, are you, you know, is there stuff you want to try and remove from the data because you think it might adulterate it in terms of different kind of play types? Like what sort of are the next steps for this sort of research?
Yeah, there's a few more wrinkles to it. You know, we throw out screen passes and passes that get released, like, within, you know, under a second after snap and things like that. They're really – so there are some things we want to maybe take into account next year would be these naked bootleg, these big play-action passes. So the Rams are really good at this. Part of the Rams' secret to their success was Goff was pretty much unpressured on a lot of plays because they would do this naked bootleg play-action. Mm-hmm. And so the linemen, it really didn't matter, especially on the weak side, the non-play side. They could do whatever they wanted and mm-hmm. go after second level guys or do whatever and not have to worry about giving up pressure. So we will probably add something in there for that. The next step really is I want to take a look at run blocking, which is much harder. And right. big reason we started with pass blocking is it's relatively simple compared to run blocking. You have to know, you know, you have to have a somewhat of an idea of the scheme of the assignment. That's going to take a little bit more time to develop.
Yeah, of course. It seems like it's much more complicated to me, at least, just as a layman. All right, Brian, you have a really fascinating paper you published at Sloan this year that I really want to talk about. But first, let's talk about ZipRecruiter. Guys, hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. No fun. Today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. That's my promo code. We'll get to that in a second. But first, just so you know about ZipRecruiter, it sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards. But they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and then invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. You can't beat that. And ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. No waiting for weeks, no sorting through mediocre resumes to get the one that actually works out. ZipRecruiter gets you the right candidate fast. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address. No one else has this web address. ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell, my last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L, ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now back to the show. Speaking of things that are complicated to me as a layman, you released a paper at Sloan this year which uses the player tracking data to measure a quarterback's decision-making. We talked a little bit about this, you know, on our own at ESPN, but I think this is, if I'm not mistaken, the first time we talked about it publicly. It's really, really, really fascinating. It's really cool. And I, you know, in talking to you about it, I'm really excited about it. In terms of this research, what goes into the sort of, decision-making process, or what is it evaluating about the quarterback decision-making process? And then what is it capable of predicting, and how good is it at predicting that those sort of, the sort of various factors you mentioned in this paper?
Yeah, this thing we called it Deep QB, and it was, you know, we had access to all this player tracking data, and we wanted, like, what's the you know, if the sky's the limit, what would you want to do with this? You know, at the end of the day, if you had all the tools available, you had all the time available, what would you want to do? And so this was that effort. This was like, hey, what's possible? What's the art of the possible? Mm-hmm. And so the result was this Deep QB model. It uses neural networks, so artificial intelligence. So one of the things, the player tracking data, there's so much data, and it's so visual, it's so geometric, that traditional kinds of analytic methods, regressions or tree-based model, things like that don't work very well. So we go to these much more powerful models like neural networks. Mm-hmm. And in this case, what it's doing is it's looking at the play, it's looking at the receivers, it's looking at all the defenders, looking at whether the quarterback's under pressure or not, and it's saying, what's the probability the quarterback's going to throw to each of its 5 eligible receivers? Mm-hmm. And the idea originally was good quarterbacks who are making good decisions will throw to the kind of the league consensus, like who should you pass to is the same as who would a league average quarterback pass to. Mm-hmm. We assume that a quarterback is not making an error in reading the field on average. And so we could compare on every play. We could say, hey, here's the probability you should throw to him, here's the probability you should throw to him, and so on. And those probabilities will be very high if the mm-hmm. receiver's open and downfield and there's no chance of interception. And it'll be very low if the receiver's well covered. And that all worked really, really well. The thing is that quarterbacks are so different that who Aaron Rodgers would throw to is very, very different than, say, you know, who Josh Rosen would throw to. Mm-hmm. Even though they're making decisions, probably, you know, the best decisions they can given their protections and given their abilities and things like that.
Right.
So that's what it does. It does a lot more, predicts interception probabilities, completion percentage, yards gained on every play. So we can use the same model, just ask it any number of different questions and ask it to predict it, and it does a pretty good job.
How well does it predict where quarterback is actually going to throw the football, given, you know, where the defenders are located, what the quarterback is, you know, where the quarterback's located, where his receivers are? How well does it predict where the quarterback is going to go with the football, given all those sort of, you know, all the sort of data you throw into it?
It predicts the receiver 60% of the time.
Wow.
Which doesn't sound great, right? That sounds like,
I don't know. That's pretty good.
That's like a D-, but it's very, very good. And the reason is there are five of these receivers out there. So you're starting from kind of your starting point. Your naive starting guess would be you'd be 20% correct. So we're tripling that. Plus, quarterbacks aren't always making the right decision. Plus, there are lots of cases where there might be two receivers that are each getting, say, 40% probability, and he'll just throw to one or the other. And so it actually performs really well. If this piece of artificial intelligence was your actual quarterback, it would probably be a pretty, you know, league average passer.
Now, what I find really interesting, and you sort of bring up why this might be the case and what it might mean in the paper, is you mentioned when a quarterback throws to the receiver who the deep QB model predicts, he has a really good completion percentage, but he isn't quite as optimal in another way, which might have sort of some further indications about the decisions quarterbacks make.
Yeah. So the completion percentages are really high when the actual quarterback agrees with the model and throws to the receiver that the model would predict. So the completion percentages are, I don't know, through the roof, like 70-something percent. Mm-hmm. And then, but so you would think, okay, the yards per attempt, the actual gain on the play would be proportionately large as well. But it turns out that's not the case. So the insight there is that what quarterbacks are doing is they're kind of optimizing for completion. They're not really optimizing for overall production. So I think that has a lot to do with scheme. I think there are, just from watching a ton of plays through the player tracking, kind of through film over the past couple years, I've noticed there are a lot of plays that are kind of single read plays where four of these receivers might be decoys, and the ball was always going to go to this one, you know, 1 yard tight end out kind of thing.
Right.
And what's happening is that there are some of these decoy routes are actually really just very wide open home run type plays, and the quarterback's never looking there, and he never was going to look there. So I think there's, you know, it's a really complicated thing, and I think there's a lot going on, but one of the insights, and this is no different from what coaches do, from what most, you know, throughout sports, is that humans are risk averse, and it seems like quarterbacks and coaches and offensive coordinators and everything, they're no different. They're making the safe decision more often than not, rather than going for a more optimal but slightly more risky play.
Right. In terms of thinking about the player tracking data as a whole, I mean, obviously, you know, we see it with baseball. We have, you know, we have ball tracking data with baseball that is extremely meaningful and has shown predictive value. We have player tracking data in basketball. We have player tracking data in soccer. I'm not sure about hockey. I'm just not informed enough to say that. But in terms of the NFL, this is still a relatively new technology in terms of when it's being introduced to teams and teams having access to multiple teams' data. Do you think teams around the league, without any specifics, just in terms of the broader sort of conversations you're hearing from analytics people or executives around the league, do you think teams are actually using this data in a meaningful way at the moment to make the same sort of inferences or test the same sort of research questions that you're testing here?
I think they're just getting started to. So the data has only been available to the teams themselves for 1 year.
Right.
The before that, they only got access to their own 11 players. And so it was kind of like watching somebody shadow box, because it really, you weren't getting much useful information. Kind of information they were getting were things like, you know, player speeds. So maybe you could detect, you know, fatigue levels, or mm-hmm. how long is this cornerback? He's been playing man to man, snap after snap after snap. You know, how does his speed affected, things like that. So, you know, just more basic analysis. But now that they get data to not only their own team, but their opponents and all, you know, all 267 games throughout the season, they're starting to do some of the kinds of things that we've been doing at ESPN. We've had the data for, I think, you know, over 2 years now, almost 3 years, I would guess. And
yeah.
They're just starting to figure this out now. Teams are hiring people to wrap their arms around this data and start to try to make sense of it. They are interested in things like the NFL just had this competition, like a sort of Kaggle-like competition, like mm-hmm. a hackathon type thing called,
right.
They called it the Big Data Bowl. And they released some of this information, some of the player tracking data, I think about 70 games worth, and they released it, and you could sign up, do some analysis on it, and they selected finalists who went to the combine and presented their results there. So the league is very interested in it. The teams are very interested in it, but they really haven't had the time yet. Mm-hmm. It is so much data. It's so complicated. It takes you, you know, weeks, months, whatever, to just start wrapping your arms around it and figuring out, you know, what's there? What can we do with it?
Mm-hmm. But do you think, and again, like, obviously there's still a lot more research, a lot more time, a lot more, you know, certainly the data is an enormous sample, but just in terms of the consistency of the data, still plenty more games and years to go. Do you think there is a competitive advantage to be had if you're the first team or one of the first few teams who does, you know, sort of wrangle this data into something that is more usable?
I definitely think so. And I think I'm on the outside looking in. I'm not on the inside on a team. I don't know their schemes. I don't know their, you know, what they're trying to do. I don't know I don't know the matchups that they're trying to generate. And so I think this data can really help teams analyze those sorts of things. But I think at the same time though, teams already have the resources to review the film themselves. So the coaches are much better, you know, model themselves. Their football brain is a very good model, right? Mm-hmm. Like deep QB or something like that. They understand football very, very well. And so the problem is scale, right? And scope. So I think it was like Bill James, you know, said like, you know, hey, look, the stats watch every game. They watch every at-bat of every game ever played. Like even the best coach in the world will never see more than a handful of games from any given week on any Sunday, right? So they have this really limited sample size. They can't watch every single, I want to see every single Patriots cover four mm-hmm. that they've ever played for the past, you know, 2 years. Well, you can't really, how do you watch all of their film? How much time would that take a quality control coach to do mm-hmm. to just find those plays and then go watch them and try to derive some sort of insight out of that? So what the player tracking data and the kind of models we can use to apply to them, to the data, allows you to do things at a speed and at a scale that maybe you definitely couldn't do as a human. You could do, but just at a much smaller scope.
Right. Well, if people want to check out this paper, I believe they can do that. Do you have a link to it on your Twitter, by any chance?
Yeah, here's just Google like Sloan Deep QB, something like that. Yeah, it's under the 2019 paper. It was one of the finalists there at Sloan this year, Sloan Sports Analytics Conference, which is where we all get together every, beginning of March to mm-hmm. talk about sports analytics.
Yes, sports analytics and things vaguely related to sports analytics sometimes as well. If people want to check you out, want to read more of the stuff you're doing, where do you publish that stuff?
I haven't been writing lately. I've had my head buried doing these models. So, but ESPN.com/analytics typically has our stuff. So we've got a number of different articles out there that, you know, say pass block win rate is getting used throughout the platform, all across ESPN. So you don't need to read an article by me to get that stuff.
Awesome. Well, Brian, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Bill.
All right, thanks so much to my guest today, ESPN's Brian Burke, one of the smartest guys at the company. Strongly recommend checking out ESPN.com/analytics. Also, strongly recommend subscribing to the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny. Partly for Mina, good friend, really talented colleague of mine, mostly for Lenny, and I think Mina would agree with me there. Subscribe to that show. Thanks so much for listening. We have more audio coming next week.